Over the last decade, weapons technology has adapted to the needs of an evolving military theater, and it's changed the face of modern warfare. Unmanned aerial vehicles, commonly referred to as drones, are the most widely used, as well as one of the most controversial introductions to the battlefield. In a new documentary, Nova explores the history of the drone, the current uses they have, the controversy surrounding them, and their future possibilities. Rise of the Drones premieres tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on PBS, and here to discuss it is Emmy-nominated writer, producer, and director Peter Yost. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much, Leonard.
Why do we call unmanned aerial vehicles drones?
It's a good question, and it depends who the we are.
Well, the military doesn't use that phrase.
Correct.
They kind of sneer when you use the word drone.
Yeah, they absolutely reject it, in fact, and they say this is the public and the media that calls these things drones. And they reject it, I think, in part because it implies, of course, that they're not only unmanned, but it implies that they're sort of that there's nobody home, nobody controlling these things. And they find that an offensive and problematic statement. And so they much prefer the phrase RPA, which stands for remotely piloted aircraft. And so there is, even in making the film, right there from the beginning, the problem of semantics. How do we refer to these things? What do we call them? And again, the military RPA, frankly, they're known as drones to us and to the masses.
Did any particular event prompt the investment in this kind of technology?
I think there were a number of incidents over the course of history that made this an appealing direction to move in from a military standpoint. I mean, for many decades, of course, there's been surveillance in manned planes. There were incidents.
We had the U-2s.
Of course.
And earlier we had blimps that were doing the job.
Absolutely. But you always had the risk of pilot loss, of course. Going back to the Cold War with Gary Powers and the Khrushchev incident and many other things along the way. I mean, even if you look at Clinton's foreign policy and Black Hawk Down and Somalia, the idea of actually putting boots on the ground for small or large goals could really backfire and alter foreign policy.
Weren't tests of remotely operated planes initiated as early as World War II?
Absolutely. And there was a clever approach that they took, and we actually have some rare footage of this in the film, which is quite amazing to see, where the pilots, you could control these essentially using radio control, but you had to be close enough to actually control the target. And so you would bail out with a parachute after launching the plane or flying, and you fly nearby and then jump out of it. And we actually have footage from that era of people parachuting out.
Well, you have to be close by when you play with one of those remotely controlled planes in your backyard. Was it a similar kind of technology?
Back then, they were remote controlled, absolutely. And now we've moved into this new era, both for the big guys, of course, the military, but increasingly for those of us who want to do this in our backyard or fly them off our iPhones as well, where, of course, there are limits to the range, but with the introduction of satellite control systems, which are in fact how the Predators work, the famous kind of big ones, and the Reapers, which are the follower, the more modern Predator, if you will, and then the Global Hawk, which is even the largest of all, at least the largest that we know of that are out there. But those basic forms of technology, the GPS control, are accessible in moderate forms for small few hundred dollar hobbyists as well.
So we needed something like that to really be able to come up with seriously operable drones? I mean, they started introducing drones in the 70s before we ever had any satellites.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the people that we highlight, I would almost say, in our film is a man named Abe Karam, who very few people know about. He hadn't spoken in a film up until this point, and he's widely known as the quote-unquote father of the Predator. And he's sort of a idiosyncratic, clever inventor, an aeronautic expert. But he, in the 70s, started building in his garage out of very basic materials what ultimately became the Predator drone. But up until that point, there wasn't the GPS system, the data links, the lightweight composites, the digital flight control systems that would make these things possible.
And one of the other things that makes it possible is you don't have a pilot. So you don't have to factor in the pilot's weight and all of the things, the controls that he or she would require.
Absolutely. And we worked with some modern-day fighter pilots and manned planes today, and we actually drummed up, I think, a statistic that I think has not been found before, but that basically the ejection system, the weight of the pilot, and his or her seat alone weighs more than the entire Predator drone does. So it's a world of difference.
And it's called Predator, obviously. That's meant to sound threatening. Was it seen as a weapon carrier from the start?
In the earliest days, and again to reference back to Abe Karam, the inventor of these, he never intended them, in fact, to be armed at all. He saw these as surveillance tools that, again, could do an end run around the possibility of pilot loss and avoid a Gary Power-esque incident. In fact, what happened is, these were first developed in the mid to late 90s. They really came into fruition as these other technologies developed. And then something happened, of course, in 2001, and there was no longer a standoff between the Cold War armies of tens of thousands of tanks, but rather we started to target individuals. And for that, you could fold the surveillance technology and what they call in military parlance, find, fix, finish, the ability to not just find, but also to take somebody out at once into the same craft.
So they suddenly seemed ideal for a post-Cold War world.
Yes, indeed. And again, the person who invented them, and this is often what happens with technology, had, according to his tales, no intention of ever arming these. But of course, it's gone in a different direction. And we point out that as we look at the current and the future technologies that are coming out, many of the people working on them have the same notion that these aren't intended for military purposes, but in fact, if the technology is there, they'll be put to different uses.
How soon after 9/11 did we see the first armed drone attack?
The first attack, and we actually in our film have a man named General David Deptula, who is the head of the Air Force's ISR, Intelligence Surveillance Reconnaissance Agency, and a lieutenant general who was in charge of the air campaign in Afghanistan. He actually oversaw the first use of that in 2001 in Afghanistan. So it was fairly soon afterwards.
And since that time, the U.S. Air Force is training more remote pilots than fighter and bomber pilots, isn't it?
Yep, fighter and bomber pilots combined, indeed.
Now, how are they trained? Are they put on some kind of an Xbox and told to play video games?
Essentially. It's not quite that extreme, but almost. They actually can take literally folks off the street. And they're interesting studies because, again, as I said, we worked and we're interested in the film in comparing the manned pilots versus the unmanned and the skill sets that are required. And there actually have been studies showing that people coming off the street can actually perform better flying RPAs or drones than experienced pilots, because the experienced people who've actually left the ground and piloted something bring in a set of skills that are actually detrimental to what it takes.
And they have a certain amount of contempt. I know I've spoken to a number of old-time pilots. They have contempt for these new pilots. In fact, they don't want them to be called pilots.
Absolutely. I think, it's not for me to say. Ultimately, if they all have contempt, and I think a number of them have moved across. We actually have somebody in our film who's quite amazing life story, a woman named Missy Cummings, who was one of the Navy's first female fighter pilots and went through quite a hazing, as you can imagine, in the 80s, kind of becoming a Top Gun female fighter pilot, and then turned ship, if you will, and is now an engineering professor at MIT specializing in RPA or drone development and remote technologies. And she's come under some attack, or that's too strong a word, but some fire from her ex-fighter pilot peers for jumping ship.
My guest is Peter Yost, who wrote, produced, and directed a documentary called Rise of the Drones, which will be broadcast tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on PBS stations. How do you go about making a film like this? I would assume that when you call the Air Force, they say, I'm sorry, we really don't want to talk to anybody about this. We sure don't want anybody to film these drones.
Yeah, absolutely. Needless to say, that was a huge hurdle. And we spent a while, really, we wouldn't take no for an answer. We ultimately had to have our access signed off by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff himself. So this wasn't just kind of a backdoor. I knew a cousin who knew somebody else, but actually it really was a top-down thing. And of course, that journalistically raises other problems. It's a wonderful opportunity, but then what does that mean? Are they going to be controlling the film? And the Air Force was allowed to review a rough cut of the film in order to, for national security purposes or for blatantly incorrect facts, but not to weigh in on content in the least.
So they didn't try to change the tone of this?
No, we got numerous comments from many members of the Air Force and other branches making, quote-unquote, suggestions about what they would like, but that's life in the big city, and we were under no obligation to take them.
Well, you do leave it to the viewer to make his or her own decision as to whether this is a good idea.
Absolutely. And I think it's very difficult. I mean, I think it's like any technology. I came into this, and I think there's a tendency to be very polarized on this issue. They are perhaps by nature rather creepy. there's nobody home, as it were, in the sense that you're moving into this Terminator-like world. But in fact, I think the moral issues are incredibly complicated.
Well, we have these people who are manning or controlling these planes, these RPAs, from a real distance from the where they're actually operating, in Nevada, most of them?
They're actually scattered in a number of different places, a number in Nevada, absolutely. Yeah.
So there's a real disconnect. It is almost like playing a video game, and they're trained on Xbox controllers. So isn't there a concern that what they're doing is a little removed from reality?
Absolutely. And I think that's a valid criticism or question. What I would mention is I've recently, previously done a film for Nova, actually, on Viking swords. And I would argue that since that era, when you had to stand face-to-face with somebody sword-to-sword, that was a certain kind of fighting. Since that point, we've been ever more removed from face-to-face combat.
And there was concern that even bombers, the higher up they could go, more and more led to this sense of disconnect. But still, you could see the impact of what you've done right below you. In this case, you're watching everything on a video screen.
Absolutely. Although it's interesting, the people who run these RPAs, actually, because they can loiter for so many hours, we don't know exact numbers, but for more than 24 hours at a time with a predator, for example, and the cameras are so good that they're watching somebody for many hours often before they strike them, and again for many hours even afterwards. So whereas a bomber pilot, emotionally, in a human level, might drop a plane, or drop a bomb, turn around and go back to base, but never see the damage, these people, in a way, are closer, albeit in a remote sense, than ever before.
We've carried out covert operations with drones in countries like Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia. Does the use of drones in these countries violate international law?
I think there are a number of people who say that it does. It certainly raises questions that have not been raised in this way before. And we put it, I think, out in the film for people to decide for themselves. But what's absolutely clear is that these are issues that have to be codified and have to be dealt with.
And it has caused trouble with relations with a country like Pakistan.
Absolutely.
Why has President Obama accelerated and expanded the drone program, considering the fact that it causes international tension?
I think, and this is just arguably, of course, my speculation, but I think they're an irresistible technology, for better or worse, for somebody in his position, because you are not risking a Somalia-like incident politically, assuming that they have people that they want to take out, which is, you know, people can differ on their positions on that. But if you are going to go after these things, and in the past, rather than funding the Contras behind the scenes or secret bombing Cambodia with carpet bombing them, these are, they would argue, very precise ways of doing this sort of dirty work.
Well, how precise are they? Of the many criticisms of drones, one is that an estimated 30% of the people killed by drone strikes are civilians.
Yeah, I think that's we mentioned that in our film, and I think that's a very tricky question to answer. We try to drill down into the technology and look at that and answer them. The weapons themselves are highly precise, but of course any weapon system is only as good as the technology going into the decision making.
And then there's a disagreement as to who is a civilian and who is a real target.
Absolutely. There are places in North Waziristan, for example, where they have at various points deemed any male between the certain ages, don't quote me on the exact number, but I believe it roughly 15 and 50, to be a lawful legal combatant, which means any male who was hit is considered an enemy of war.
Any male with a gun?
Not even necessarily. Somebody who is in the context of other people who might have guns.
Are drone strikes more accurate than piloted strikes?
I think that the weapon systems are very similar. So the actual munitions are not necessarily more accurate. The argument I think that people would make, however, is that, again, because you can survey for so many hours, it's not just a plane zooping in, hitting a target that was radioed to them, but rather one can watch for many hours or even days, make sure that that is, in fact, Leonard Lopate coming out of his car, and then strike accordingly.
And how accurate are the cameras? I hear the most sophisticated cameras in the world have been installed into some of these drones.
Yeah, well, we have a segment in the film, actually, about, and it's the first time that it's ever been released to the public, knowledge of this particular device. In the past, Predators, the most famous killer drones, if you will, have cameras that can easily make out people from 5 to 6 miles above, but they have, it's almost like looking through a soda straw. You have a very limited range of view. You don't see the wide angle. So what they've done is built these new 1.8 billion, that's with a B, pixel. For those of you with cell phones, it's a lot bigger than that. Pixel cameras that can see an entire city at once.
And it's called Argus?
Argus, yes.
Thank you so much for being with us. A lot more in this film, a fascinating film called Rise of the Drones, which will be shown tomorrow night at 9 p.m. on PBS stations. Peter Yost wrote, produced, and directed it, and he has been my guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you.